welcome to the Sister Sounds podcast. Oh gosh, it's been such a long time since I've made one of these shows. It's been well over a year and I've really missed it. I've been busy with finishing my dissertation for my master's, life after COVID and so much other stuff. But last year I spoke to Dr. Julie Scanlon and we had a really good discussion on my old show on Pride Radio, where we talked about lesbian visibility, women's rights, Black Lives Matter from a woman's context, and just loads more. So I'm really excited to bring you this podcast today because, yeah, it's just been a long time and I really, really enjoyed the discussion with Julie. So without much more waffle from me, here was the discussion that I had with Julie on the 7th of June, 2020.
First, thanks a lot for having me on the show as a guest, Chantal. I appreciate the chance to just have a chat. My academic background, yes, I was an academic all my life until about 3 years ago. So I was an academic for about 14 years. And my research and teaching interests were around gender and sexuality, and particularly their representation in contemporary culture, and thinking about how the social construction operates in the world around us. So I mainly focused on things like film, television, literature, popular culture, in the contemporary world, really, and how those things shape and perpetuate the ideas that people have about gender and sexual orientation. So that was kind of my main research and teaching interests. And when I was an academic, I just got more and more interested in, as well, kind of turning my feminist lens, if you like, onto the structures of academia itself. So I started becoming more interested in big organizations like universities and other kind of organizational cultures, and how these great big hierarchical structures tend to hinder women in many respects. So we don't see many women in leadership positions, for example. And that's multiplied if you're a Black woman, a lesbian woman, a woman with a disability, etc.
Or the intersection.
So my academic stuff, you know, kind of started to just mold out in different kind of shapes before I left, really.
And where did you study? Where did you first study?
That's a little history. It's not very exciting. I went to what is now Birmingham City Poly. Birmingham City University. It was a poly at the time, where I did my first degree, my BA. Then I did my postgraduate work, MA and PhD at the University of Sheffield.
And how did you end up here?
I ended up here because academic jobs are hard to come by, and this is where the job was. And I'd never set foot in Newcastle before, and I just loved it when I came up for an interview, which is really good because I've ended up just making my home here and putting down roots, definitely.
And how long have you actually been here?
16, 17 years now, I think, something like that.
That's about as long as I've been here. I got here in 2003.
Right.
And I haven't left. I'm still here.
It does that to you. You actually can't get away.
When you leave and you come back.
Yeah, right. Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Newcastle's a good place to be.
It is. It is. Especially at the moment, I feel like it's a good place to be.
Yeah.
I would definitely prefer to be here than in London or somewhere right now.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. What does your self-employed work involve?
Yeah, I have sort of three interrelated strands, really, that I focus on now that I'm self-employed. And it's all kind of working with my values. That's the core of it all. So my first strand is about the equality and diversity sort of training that you mentioned, the equality and diversity work. And that's kind of in broad, quite general terms. So it might be about how to create inclusive cultures. We might be thinking about so-called unconscious bias. I always want to put that in inverted commas, obviously, and kind of various other sort of introductory topics. And then I specialize as well in particular into gender, so representations of women and helping support women in the workplace, and also in LGBT inclusion. The second strand of my role is as a coach, a professional development and career change coach. So that's often supporting people to make career decisions or to improve their work-life balance, or perhaps just simply ways of working that work better for them. My third aspect is my consultancy work, which is my research and evaluation work that I do in the public and third sector mostly.
Okay.
And that involves helping charities or other organisations, usually sort of evaluating their projects to report on their impact to funders, beneficiaries and sort of the wider public, really.
That sounds
sort of a bit a mixed bag of things, but the core of it is like I'm attached to the projects and the people that I work with and that share my values, really.
And which one do you find the most rewarding?
Oh, that's difficult. I get a different kick out of each of those different aspects. The coaching, for example, is just wonderful when you see a person develop in front of your eyes and like you see their light bulb moments. And I know it sounds cliched, but some people in a coaching session can have like quite a life-changing moment and a big realization moment, and that's wonderful to be part of that and to be simply a witness to, you know, to them sort of developing themselves and you know, whatever it is that they're working on, just really getting to grips with that. So I do love that as well. As I enjoy the training and the sort of facilitation work, because again, it feels like I'm sort of helping people to understand why these things are important, and you know, just making a little bit of a difference and chipping away at the huge inequalities that we have, which are obviously very transparent right now.
Oh well, yeah, magnified right now. And when you say you specialise in LGBT and gender equality, what does that involve?
Yeah, it's really trying to just support people, usually in organisations, through the training that I design and deliver. So I draw on my sort of academic expertise of seeing the way that gender and sexual orientation is constructed in the social world. And I create workshops or programmes for organisations and kind of tailor it to their particular needs.
Okay.
So sometimes in terms of gender, for example, we might be talking about ways to reach out to more women, to get more women into the organization. Or we might be thinking about how to, you know, kind of create different processes to support women getting into leadership roles, because different organizations have a different kind of feel and different difficulties. I said different a lot there. I'm going to try not to use that again.
Okay. We forgive you.
So thanks very much. Thanks, you're very generous. So, you know, that might come down to things like, oh, thinking about what sort of promotion criteria you've got. Is it around a particular notion of leadership, traditional notions of leadership have been quite masculinist, you know, and the sort of language that we use around that, even the word leader, for example. But I'm hoping that, you know, now that I think probably a lot of the world has fallen in love with the New Zealand PM, Jacinda Ardern.
Oh, wow,
Ardern.
Yeah. Well, yeah,
see,
definitely.
You too. Yeah. We can see that different forms of leadership are so valuable and successful, to use that word. And indeed, the world might be a better place if we have more diverse leaders in the world. So it's got to support organisations to think around, you know, what does that promotion criteria look like? What are you expecting from people in terms of the things that they're supposed to have ticked off?
And on Twitter last week as well, I spend way too much time on Twitter. If you want to follow me, it was on there, Julie Scan. And I saw that a mother was talking about her daughter being in tears at realizing that the superhero shoes were for boys. They were meant for boys. So actually in tears. So this kind of, again, what we're allowed to do, very much contemporary, what we're funneled into doing. So this gender binary, it's a hierarchy. This culturally associated with boys and men are felt to be bigger, more important, given more social status, more economic status, as we see the kind of spaceman that gets out in the world, and the anything that's associated with girls and women is given lower status in our world for the most part. So in terms of the way that these things help channel us into careers, of course, being at a university, we'll know about the sorts of numbers that we get in terms of students in STEM subjects, the science, technology, engineering, math subjects versus arts and humanities, for example. And this funnels through into the industrial workplace. So I looked up the stats. So women who are employed in STEM industries at the moment, in 2017, 24% of employees in STEM subjects are women. It's improving slowly. But until we get children at this point recognising that anything is open to them, that kind of continues, of course.
Thinking about LGBT inclusion, it can be quite simple things about, you know, what have you got on your website? What does it look like when you look at your organisation? Is it welcoming to LGBT people? You know, do you actually just sort of have any particular kind of programs in place to support people that might need additional support, because we have, you know, a lot of barriers.
Yeah, definitely.
So it might be sort of thinking about how to be an LGBT ally, for example. Mm-hmm. These sort of things that need to be backed up, of course, by walking the walk. So having, you know, a genuine culture of inclusion, I suppose, to put in the pride flag on your website as well.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes we can forget that others don't think about these kinds of things as much as we do. So you can say some quite basic things and it makes an impact on people. And I'll give you an interesting example. I was at an event, it was like a businessy type event, not my usual kind of thing, a couple of years ago, and I was talking about what I did, and not one but two people separately asked me throughout the day what LGBT meant.
What?
And I was literally saying, L is for lesbian, G is for gay, etc. So
wow.
It really made me stop and think, like you, okay, I do make assumptions that people know we exist as a group. And
how could you have escaped those?
I don't know.
Where are you?
I don't know where you are, what you're watching, what you're reading, but it's clearly not the things that I'm watching and reading.
Basically, it would be on television, website, surely. I don't understand.
It is extraordinary, isn't it? But you know, this is where some people are. So there is such a need for some awareness, some really basic awareness raising in many contexts.
Yeah, on that note, I want to ask you about Lesbian Visibility Week, which happened in April. Now, with COVID, it kind of went on the wayside a bit, I guess, for a lot of people. We didn't get to sort of raise awareness like we should have. But can you tell the audience about that? Tell everyone about that.
Yeah, that's right. Of course. I mean, when we were due to chat before COVID hit us.
It was March, wasn't it? Yeah, in March.
Yeah, it would have been in March because Lesbian Visibility Day is the 26th of April. And apparently it has existed for many years, since 2008. But it was news to me last year and I started to look into it a little bit. And interestingly, the people at Diva magazine, mostly I think, but also supported by people like Stonewall, etc., decided to make a week of it this year.
Okay.
Now, unfortunately, their week of it had to go online, but it was a series of online events, basically, that happened in April, and it was simply called Lesbian Visibility Week, and they did surveys and they had various kind of workshops and everything. So I think what's interesting for me is that we have many, many different days to celebrate various things. So we have a Bisexuality Visibility Day. We have a couple of days devoted to trans people. We have obviously general kind of LGBT days. And all of these are absolutely vital and important.
Of course, very necessary.
But there's something, you know, there's something interesting where it's the lesbian one that nobody's ever heard of. So it's a very, very invisible visibility day. So I think it's really nice that they have, you know, that they've done something with it this year. And hopefully, well, fingers crossed, we'll be post-COVID by the time it comes around next year.
Yeah, I'm hoping
so. And that organisations will get on board with it as well. And it won't just be, you know, the work that Diva put into it online this year.
And, you know, this might be a stupid question, and for us it's not, but for some people it will be a question. What makes lesbian visibility so important?
Yeah, I mean, even me sort of talking about what is LGBT there is something that some people mm-hmm. don't know about. I think what makes it so important is it's if you can't see something, how do you know what's possible?
Yeah.
You know, so if there's limited visibility, lesbian role models, for example,
yes.
How can younger women or indeed older women who come out in later life, you know, and there are many of them, how can anyone have anyone to sort of relate to and think, oh, yeah, okay, I see, that's possible, that's a possible way of living, that's okay. So to have someone that is a bit like you or looks mm-hmm. a bit like you is really important for people to be able to identify with. It's a validation of an identity. And I know, obviously, we've come a long way, but we're still not kind of far enough. We still don't see mm-hmm. enough of those examples, of particularly kind of different types of, of lesbians as well. So, you know, heterosexual people get this everywhere. Adverts, film, TV, mm-hmm. media. If you're walking down a shopping street, all the adverts that are alongside you, shopping mall, you get what's called heteronormativity everywhere. Mm-hmm. That sense that, you know, to be straight is the norm. And indeed, the majority of people arguably are straight. That's not a problem. But the sense that, you know, sometimes it might be nice to just see yourself represented yeah. in a positive way is really important.
Yeah, I did a speech yesterday for the Black Lives Matter online.
I heard it was powerful, yeah. fantastic. Thank you.
But yeah, you know, I said in my speech that I didn't see anybody that looked like me, spoke like me in my young life, my teens, and I had no access to seeing that at all, no internet. Even in films, there was nothing there at all. So what do you do if you can't see anything like that? You become invisible and the ideas around you become invisible and you don't have anywhere to go to see them.
Yeah.
And it's not the same. We didn't have that then, same as you wouldn't have had. We didn't have anywhere to go. You know, even magazines, you know, our sort of magazines might have been on the top shelf if they were there at all. You know, shame top shelf or in the deep, dark layers of somewhere. It was so not shown. That, again, it's all this intersectionality of being queer or gay, however you define it, and then the intersectionality of that disabled, black, Asian, you know, we still don't see this enough.
No.
It's still not visible.
No, absolutely. We don't see different kinds of representations, and it just, you know, it just really makes a difference because there's been a historically in lesbian culture and also in gay men's culture as well mm-hmm. of kind of looking for clues and reading into relationships and you know imagining film stars as gay etc mm. and that sense of needing to fantasize is like in one way it's creative mm-hmm. but it's also down to having so few representations and as you say not knowing where to go, if you're not seeing any black people on TV, you're not seeing any Asian people on TV, anyone that is not kind of straight and white, how, you know, if you're thinking that you're wanting to see something like yourself and kind of see a positive model mm-hmm. and they're just not there and you just sort of, you know, that sense is really, it's a really been an important lack. And there's still, obviously, there's just not enough of it. Mm. There's not enough diversity.
There really isn't. And even when I'm watching TV now, the idea of lesbians on the television are usually two very beautiful white women mm-hmm. rolling around on a bed, putting some pictures on a wall, sweeping long hair, having a laugh, a giggle, and I don't see anyone that looks like any of us, really.
I know. This is a bit naughty, but not too naughty, don't worry.
Okay. Getting you worried here. Ofcom.
In some research that I did, one of the participants referred to it as the kind of the long-haired lassies are the people that we see on screen as represented as lesbians. Now, there's nothing wrong with long-haired feminine lesbians. I'd like to make that
wrong
point.
With long. It's hard to say. Wrong with long.
Wrong with long. Wrong with long hair.
They exist.
They exist, but they're, you know, they're one kind of person that exists. Mm-hmm. And the fact that if you don't see someone that's, you know, looks a little bit butch or, you know, goodness me, you know, a black butch lesbian or this kind of sense of a lack of the lack of what we might actually look like. And, you know, who are those visuals for? I think we sort of know that, don't we?
Yes. Male gaze.
Yeah. And just as an example from my own life, only last week, I was walking to work and there was a dad and his son, probably the son was about 3 or 4, just started at school, and they were sort of ambling about a little bit in front of me, and the dad said to his son, "Oh, let's let this lady go past." And as I walked past, I heard the son say, "Daddy, that's not a lady." And this sense of he's already learned at age 3, someone like this isn't a lady, in inverted commas. So he sees the back of my head, you know, short hair, blah, blah. I'm not your stereotypical feminine lady. Obviously, you know, I didn't turn around and give a lecture to the young boy. I carried on walking onto the metro stop. But again, it's this kind of thing. 2019, we're funneling people into what those expectations are. I wasn't performing my gender right for that young boy. I didn't hear what the dad said, actually. That might have been more amusing to loiter and hear what the dad said in response.
Sister Sounds.
Organisations and workplaces are huge kind of cultural institutions quite often, and they have a part to play in making everyone feel welcomed and valued. And there's been a lot of research, there's some good research that's happened, I think mostly in the States, that I'm aware of, around how lesbians don't feel they can be as comfortable being themselves in the workplace. Mm-hmm. They are more likely to be sexually harassed than straight women. Actually, bisexual women top the peak of that.
Really?
And then it's
wow.
Lesbian women.
I did not know that.
And also to be, you know, just to be able to kind of talk about your own personal life and the kind of sense of the sort of the cultural safety, the psychological safety is actually
yes.
a term that's used about being able to be yourself. And it's not about saying who you had sex with. Like everyone wants to kind of reduce it to that. But
yeah.
if you hear about somebody in work that's, you know, getting engaged and it's like a straight couple, you don't immediately think, oh, yeah, this is about sex. It's actually just simply about being able to be yourself and be open.
Mm-hmm.
And the stats tell us that, you know, a lot of people are not feeling that. So I've got the stats in front of me about, so this is a huge study. It was McKinsey study.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, 2019, this came out, 68,500 US employees, right? So this is massive. And what they found was like 53% of the lesbians that they surveyed reported experiencing sexual harassment in the workplace. So that's 53%. For bisexual women, it was 62%. And then for women overall, it was 41%.
And you can just...
They're just extraordinary. This is why we need some attention into kind of different kinds of women in the workplace, I think.
And you know those, what kind of lewd things they'll be saying to people and questions.
Yeah.
And people don't realise that even that kind of thing, it doesn't have to be overt kind of comments.
Mm-hmm.
It can be just little suggestions, even asking about your sex life or saying, you know, who's the guy, who's the girl, even those kind
yeah.
of things.
Yeah.
Anything that you find uncomfortable like that is sexual harassment.
Mm-hmm.
And
the little sort of you know, what does your husband do kind of comments, and mm-hmm. you know, if you're not a straight woman, that question is like, okay, well, how do you respond to that?
Yeah.
Like, do you bother going into what your whole identity is, or do you just like make something up? And you know, these kind of sort of cautionary moments
mm-hmm.
You know, that we have to think about, and just you have to be kind of quite guarded about what sort of information you do give out in the workplace, because sort of a lot of people are still homophobic, obviously. So we have this sense of, you know, is it safe for me to be open in the workplace? And unfortunately, a lot of people we know don't feel that it is. It depends on your organisation.
Yeah,
so I think the more that organisations can do to sort of open up those conversations. And many of them obviously celebrate, we're in Pride Month at the moment, aren't we? Many of them celebrate Pride with the, you know, they put their rainbow colours on and their logos. And obviously many of them donate to LGBT organisations, etc. But often, you know, lesbians often don't feel, well, some lesbians anyway, don't feel that they are fully part of that LGBT movement. I know that we're going to chat about that a bit later.
We are, yeah.
Well.
I'm going to go to a little bit of break and a song, and then I've got my question here about that. So I'm going to have a break now, and we'll be joined back with Dr. Julie Scanlon after the break.
And on Twitter last week as well, I spend way too much time on Twitter. If you want to follow me, it was on there, Julie Scan. And I saw that a mother was talking about her daughter being in tears at realizing that the superhero shoes were for boys, but they were meant for boys. So actually in tears. So this kind of, again, what we're allowed to do, very much contemporary, what we're funneled into doing. So this gender binary, it's a hierarchy, this culturally associated with boys and men are felt to be bigger, more important, given more social status, more economic status, as we see the kind of spaceman that gets out in the world, and the anything that's associated with girls and women is given lower status in our world for the most part. So in terms of the way that these things help channel us into careers, of course, being at a university, we'll know about the sorts of numbers that we get in terms of students in STEM subjects, the science, technology, engineering, math subjects versus arts and humanities, for example. And this funnels through into the industrial workplace. So I looked up the stats. So women who are employed in STEM industries at the moment, in 2017, 24% of employees in STEM subjects are women. It's improving slowly, but until we get children at this point recognizing that anything is open to them, that kind of continues, of course.
So we were talking about lesbian visibility before, and I just want to ask you about, do you feel that lesbians are left out of the conversations in the LGBTQI community?
Yes, definitely. I think it's not everyone's perspective, of course, but I think in the LGBTQ community, there is misogyny as there is in any other community and in wider society as a whole. And I think that quite a lot of lesbians are, you know, somewhat different, disenfranchised from those big kind of communal gatherings like Pride, and don't feel that they're respected. I mean, there was a little piece of research done just by her, which is this sort of social app and dating app for women, where they found, like, you know, quite large proportions of lesbians didn't feel welcome at Pride and didn't feel included. Really? That's kind of both in the marches and on the, you know, on the sort of Pride festival kind of thing. So that's here in the UK. Yeah. And it's really sad. It's saying that, you know, something is not speaking to lesbian women from the, in that kind of general LGBT mixed spaces. And it's, you know, and this isn't new. This is nothing new. And interestingly, I was watching a couple of weeks ago a brilliant documentary, and the BFI, the British Film Institute, have some fantastic archive stuff free online at the moment. And they've got a little series of things about LGBT history. So it's archived like documentaries and films from kind of the 70s and 80s, really. And one was called Gay Black Group. And as it says on the tin, it was about a gay black group in London in the early 80s, I think it was. And at that, in the group, there were not many women attending the group, even though it was meant to be mixed. And the women that were attending, and were obviously happy to be interviewed as part of the documentary, they were asked about that, and they talked about how it was partly due to the misogyny that they felt, that often women felt they wanted to organise separately and gather separately to be in kind of safer spaces, as it were. And I think, you know, it's a kind of, it's a sad situation that there are elements of that. And I want to stress, I'm not speaking for lesbians, obviously, but they, when you look at the research and kind of also, you know, I was just kind of chatting with friends, some women are not comfortable anymore, and this means that our voices get left out. They get left out of the decision making. If we're literally not there, we can't speak. And so, that's kind of quite problematic, obviously.
Yeah, I've been, I know that you must have seen the Lesbian Archives, about.
Yeah,
and they're making a documentary at the moment about sort of lesbian history. I don't know if it's come out yet. It's a short film. I think it's come out. But that sort of, that whole website kind of discusses sort of lesbian erasure. It's been a long-standing issue. And people are kind of afraid to speak about it as well. Really afraid to speak about it for saying these things, saying what's on their mind, because they're afraid of being called certain things. And it's quite a shame that we can't, even as women, I've been speaking to my friend who isn't, she's heterosexual, or I'm assuming she is, she might be bisexual, but we were having conversations the day, the conversations that we just feel like we can't have in public for fear of being called TERFs or being called anything, really. Even having a conversation about just women's erasure can be so problematic. And women's voices are just being silenced across the board, really. Whatever your sexuality is, we are really being silenced.
We are.
And it's,
we are. And I think it's that kind of sense of, if you speak, or if you ask for a women-only space, or if you put on a women-only space, not ask for it, the kind of aggravation that you get, it sort of then starts to make you retract and say, actually, I'm not going to do this anymore, because it's absolutely exhausting simply to be able to put something on. So you've got women that don't feel comfortable in those mixed spaces, and yet then not allowed to not allowed without a lot of aggravation to put their own events on. And then, I'm aware of kind of secret events that then go on, as I'm sure you probably are as well, just simply because they don't want the aggravation. But then that means it's not open to people that might want to come, because it's all by word of mouth.
And those secrets events, if they get found out, get called all sorts of things.
When people haven't got a clue what's going on, because nobody's inside.
That's it. There you go. That's it.
They don't believe what they're told is going on. So
it's almost they think we're having this like secret club where we just bash everybody, but actually it's more about just wanting equal rights and be able to have discussions that you can't have generally. And it's conversations that you would love to have, not privately. But when you're shouted down, you will, with any rights movement, if you're shouted down enough, it'll go underground. And then it's demonized.
And, I think we see that that's happened, because people cannot deal with the stress and the aggravation of just being shouted down every time that you open your mouth to speak. And it's just kind of this total lack of respect, that someone might have a different opinion to you, and that might be okay.
But then their opinion's allowed when they have a different opinion. But as soon as you have yours, yours is shut down as being whatever it is.
And it'll be some catch-all thing that's thrown at you, or whatever it is.
Yeah. And on that note, I wanted to ask you about the recent Black Lives Matter protests. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah. I mean, we're in an extraordinary time where, we're seeing people's anger, and this is stored up anger for, centuries, not even just, not even just decades, as it were. We know people, Black people, both here and in the US, are hugely overrepresented in, as stats, as victims of state sanctioned violence, sexual violence, domestic violence, abuse, you name it, really. And then we have the endemic racism through all of our social structures and institutions, the sort of, I'm going to put this in massive quotes, but, gentler things, banter, et cetera.
That word.
Yeah.
That does something to me.
I know,
brings
exactly
up my feelers. I don't like it.
Sorry to raise your heckles. but, George Floyd's murder has been a tipping point. It's a moment of surfacing of stuff that's already there. It's sad that some of the protests have themselves become violent, and yet also not a surprise. We have huge high emotions, and we have people that have had enough, basically. I think one of the sad things, though, around the context of COVID-19, it's really concerning to me that there were so many people on the streets. And I was really pleased that in Newcastle they made the Black Lives Matter protest online, which I think actually worked really well. And knowing from the host, when he was telling us there are 3,300 people on this call, and it's like, wow.
I know. I kept seeing it and just being like, I'm now more nervous than I was 10
seconds
ago.
You were speaking to 3,300 people. Well done.
I know, and I've seen that. I was on it yesterday and had a look, and I could see that it had like, this was way after hours later, that it had like 71,000 watches, like clicks, that people have watched it.
My God.
Yeah, so people have been watching it afterwards and will continue to watch it afterwards. And that's huge.
That is huge.
That's huge.
I think in a way it's a benefit that we do get to hear everyone's speech. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I just kind of sat and listened to everybody's speech, which I wouldn't have been able to.
Nope.
If that was happening, you know, at the Grays Monument, for example, over a PA, you'd probably hear like one word in every 30, wouldn't you? Because everyone spoke so, just so powerfully, I think, yesterday at that event. So it did work well taking it online. But
I know the protests were still happening on the monument, and as far as I can see, they went well. And there was some. I went to town afterwards. I didn't go to the monument, but I was nearby with my son and my partner, and it was amazing to see that many black young people there. You know, I barely ever see any black people in the city in one go, and it was absolutely wonderful to see them there. But afterwards, I was just urging people to isolate for 14 days afterwards. Now, we can do these protests, that's fine, you know, because especially when people use the excuse of, oh, it's going to raise COVID, but actually what's been happening in the last 3 months, it's doing it for itself anyway. But I saw nearly everyone I saw had a face mask on, and I was so happy to see that.
Yeah.
I would say that barely anyone did have a face mask on, and they were doing it as carefully as they could. But these young children are so disenfranchised, and it's a shame that a lot of them don't know the politics behind it, which is and all the structural racism that goes on. But they'll learn in time. I would hope they learn in time once these things come into school and once they can do their own research.
Yeah.
But I feel that the message out there more so needs to get out, that you really need to isolate after that.
Yeah.
After those marches. Keep contained. We'll keep it contained more so if you just stay at home.
Yes, I know.
After.
That's right. Because as we know, black and minority ethnic people are more likely to be victims of COVID due to the existing social inequalities.
Yep.
And you know, and there we are protesting against these existing social inequalities, and yet they are much more likely than the white people at those protests because of their, you know, perhaps the kind of jobs that they're in or the kind of accommodation that, you know, our unequal world is just sort of riddled through that entire activity, that entire event.
You know, they're going to be cleaners, they're going to be nurses, they're going to be working in fast food places, and they are so much more exposed, and it's that constant exposure to COVID. And people sort of link it to our genetics and blah, blah, blah. No, our mental health can be worse, and that affects your health. But it's not our genetic structure. I'm not a doctor, but from, you know, I've most likely had COVID, and I was quite ill with it. I'm asthmatic, but you know, I'm around my friends, I'm around things, but I'm fine. You know, I healed well.
Yeah.
But if I was exposed, if I worked in a hospital, or if I was a cleaner and I was exposed to that every single day, I'm sure I'd be a lot worse right now.
Yeah.
You know, my likelihood of dying would have increased exponentially.
Yeah.
And that's what we're not looking into. Looking into the socioeconomic factors of why people are getting sick and why they're dying.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, BAME nurses and doctors who are dying, but the studies that have come out have said that there's more exposure for us. We're less likely to have PPE and all those kind of things. So yeah, it's more about the institutional racism that's going on, which is kind of killing BAME people.
Yeah.
And it's as simple as, it's easy as that to say, you know, people can say, well, it's not black and white. Well, sometimes it kind of is. It's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
just don't want to see it.
Yeah, no, people don't want to see it. They want to look for other reasons. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to look for some kind of medical explanation. Mm-hmm. And actually, everything that I've read points away from that and describes exactly what you've just said around the social inequalities mm-hmm. are to blame.
And people want to try and tell you things when you, I know, I live it every day. And yeah. People really want to try and educate you and teach you. But I'm like, well, how can you teach me? You know, if you're not giving me actually any links or education or peer-reviewed things, what can you teach me when I live it every single day of my life?
Yeah.
And my family live it every day and my friends live it every day. And then you'll get somebody trying to educate you who's never even looked at it from this point of view before.
Yeah.
And I could rant about this all day.
But no, go ahead. It's worth ranting about, isn't it?
They're arbitrary social markers that help to position us into certain stratifications in terms of gender, of course. These arbitrary social markers used to be very different. It wasn't until the mid-20th century when pink came to be associated with girls. It initially used to be associated with boys. It was felt to be a strong masculine colour. And if you were a fan of The Great Gatsby, the novel, you might remember that Gatsby is wearing a pink suit. He is attempting to present himself as the ideal American man, the ideal of masculinity. When I used to teach literature over at Northumbria, students always used to go, "Oh, he's in a pink suit," and think about something about femininity, or sort of, and it was like, "Aha, no, but we're talking about early 20th century, so it's actually associated with masculinity." So that just demonstrates, it's a very simple demonstration of how we are constructed into these two supposed opposites.
Sister Sounds. Did you hear about that Bristol Monument? I don't know if you heard the news just
yes,
then.
Yes, I did. I read about it today. Yes. Mm.
So, yeah, I'm not going to air my views here. But yeah, I was very amazed. Actually, I was like, wow, did not see that coming at all.
Yeah.
And also, I wanted to ask you, I feel that black women's voices are being left out of the conversation, and there doesn't seem to be much talk about violence against black and minoritized women. Is this something that you've observed?
Yeah, it is. I absolutely agree with that. I think, you know, if people are getting their news from the mainstream news sources, what they're hearing is black men's names mm-hmm. And not black women's names. If you're in the kind of feminist news sources, you're seeing that there is so much that we need to hear about the violence against black women. And this sort of sense of, as we've used the term already, the intersectionality, you know, being black and being a woman, that means you're less likely to be talked about, recognised, listened to. Mm-hmm. And I think we are seeing that in the way that things are being reported right now as well.
And from a gender perspective, what is it that causes women to be left out of important conversations? I mean, it's probably a very hard question to answer, but yeah.
Well, yes and no. The one word answer would be patriarchy. Mm-hmm. it's a history of not being taken seriously that we're dealing with, of being treated as the second sex. So, for example, in terms of the African American experience, that Kimberly Crenshaw, who's the lawyer and academic, she didn't necessarily create the term intersectionality, but she popularized it.
She did. She brought it to the forefront.
Yeah, she brought it to the forefront, exactly. Yeah. And she talks about how, you know, people with multiple disenfranchised identities suffer their particular forms of discrimination based on the very intersection of that. Mm-hmm. And so when we have that kind of women being left out, black people being left out, people with disabilities being left out, if you, and you know, and people that are not straight, if you mold all of those together, that's a whole lot of being left out. It's kind of multiplied. I mean, in terms of women in general, Mary Beard was brilliant on this, whereas people may have read or seen her the video of her talking about the idea of men taking up public space comes from ancient Rome, where to speak in public was part of becoming a man. You know, you took up your space and you were no longer a boy and you were a man. Mm-hmm. And women never had that space. They never had that public space to speak. It wasn't part of becoming a woman. And she has these wonderful, I encourage people to look it up if they've not seen it, Mary Beard. It's on the London Review of Books website. And she just draws how these entrenched stereotypes are it's kind of what our civilization is built on. And obviously underpinning that as well, you know, it's that the sort of racism that we've got, and this kind of sense of the expectations of what it is to be a man and a woman in our society kind of just lead women to be left out of those important conversations. And I think it is a sense that we're still working with. And, entrenched stereotypes are still there. Like, you know, if you're trying to buy a child a toy at the moment, it's hard to not buy something that's pink or blue, like really hard, or clothes. And these, you know, these kind of sense of what gender roles lead us into. You know, pink and blue are just colours, but they have a cultural significance now that, you know, it means you are going to be a certain type of person. You are going to be this type of person or that type of person. And it starts so young. Yeah, what is expected of you as a girl and then as a woman.
Yeah, that's something that I think when you did that talk at the Sister Shack event, and, you know, you talked about how society is constructed for men when we were talking about, well, I'd read it already as well, but about seatbelts and...
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, and even uniforms, police uniforms are designed with men in mind. So women will find that their stab vests are too heavy, too big, and it doesn't actually protect them in any way.
Yeah, that's right. It's that Caroline Criado Perez's book that came out, I think it was last year. Mm. And, you know, and now we're seeing it with PPE that doesn't fit women appropriately and also doesn't fit a lot of Afro-Caribbean people, for example, because they're modelled on, you know, a kind of white Eurocentric features.
I find PPE quite a problem. I wear like face masks and things, and I've got a really small face. And I'm finding anything like that, even finding I've been buying face masks or the cloth ones, and some people make them really big, even for women. They're really big for me. I have a particularly small head, but, you know, different features. Of things are made with men in mind or a particular race in mind. That's really worrying for women's protection and our health.
Yeah, because this is, you know, it's health and survival that we're talking about at this particular moment, you know, especially. So it's really coming up how there's a model upon which these very kind of physical things are based, as you mentioned, the sort of seatbelts, stab vests, etc. We're supposed to be a certain type of person. And actually, not that many of us are that type of person. It's kind of an ideal man, in inverted commas, that it's built for. And that's a white man of a certain height and a certain build. Frankly, most of us are not.
Yeah, even a lot of men aren't that way either. Yeah, and yeah, it's safety for a lot of us, which is a real issue, regardless of gender. Mm. You know, we don't fit those model anymore. Probably some of us never did, and we've moved on a lot in the last 100, 200 years or however long. And yeah, it's. It's a shame that we haven't sort of moved along with it.
Yeah. So the ideas are still very much there, I think. And they just sort of take different formations in different cultures and in different historical periods, but we still have that, you know, the one word that I came to was kind of patriarchy, thinking about that question. It morphs itself, it reshapes itself for different times. So,
and also it's about recognising that there are different strands in race. You know, Afro-Caribbean is very different to African. Different African countries are different. People are shaped differently. People look yep. different. They sound different. And we're all lumped into one. And that's really not okay. It's really not okay. Yeah. And trying to explain that to people, they just it just goes over their head. They see a skin colour and go, oh, you're all the same. Whereas, you know, European look, we know about the all different types of, well, I feel like I know a lot more about, you know, different countries in Europe and all yeah. the different countries where people look different. You know, and you know a Scandinavian person is going to look very different to an English person. And but yeah, people don't know that I will look very different to somebody who was born and raised in Africa and has a long lineage of someone from a certain African country.
Yeah.
But yet we're all the same. And yeah. Hashtag all lives matters. But actually, we're all, as I said in my speech.
As you said in your brilliant speech. Yeah, listeners, if you haven't looked at Chantal's speech from the Black Lives Matters Newcastle protest yesterday, go and check it out. In fact, check out all the speeches because they were fantastic.
Yes, check them all. I love the last one, especially with Wayman. That was fantastic.
Oh, yes. What an end.
He riled me up. I was like, yes, come on.
I know. Yeah, I think everybody was raring to go.
I know, really. You're just like, come on. Can you tell me some more about the women's networks that you're involved in? Or one, I think you set up one as well. Is that right?
I set up one when I was in my workplace. I used to work at Northumbria University and I set up a network there. Mm-hmm. Which obviously I'm not part of anymore because I'm not there. I think elements of it are still going. I'm just thinking about this question. I mean, I'm not in any formal women's networks at the moment. I keep in touch with what's going on in the Northeast Women's Network through their sort of online newsletter and stuff. I have my network of female feminist friends here in the Northeast. So it's a shout out to them if any of them are listening.
I would hope so.
But it's, I guess I'm not in touch with formal, in that kind of formal sense anymore. I think women's networks are very powerful in offering that space actually to talk about things, you know, if they are genuinely kind of open and sort of safe spaces. Then it offers a space to talk away from the kind of, away from the sort of rigid hierarchies that you get in other kind of spaces, I suppose. You can create your own way of doing things, which is what I did with the Women's Network when I was at Northumbria. I tried to just have it operate differently from the way everything else worked.
I've got a question that might throw you a bit. My partner, she was messaging me saying how good you've been on, how eloquent and how articulate you've been. I mean, those weren't the words she used to search, but yeah, she was like, she's so good. And she'd like to talk to you in the future about something. But actually, I asked her if I could ask you the question, if that's okay. This might throw you off
ahead.
A bit. So I'll read it sort of verbatim. And she wants to know how you think about pride, how pride can change to not be such a commercial venture by companies slapping some rainbow flags on stuff and giving away free chicken, but go back to a political venture and actually addressing intersectionality, real issues in the community. So she wanted to ask you about that, you know, how you feel about it and how do you feel that pride can change in that way to not be so commercial?
Oh, it's a really important question, isn't it? Because I think, you know, pride has lost a lot of its roots. It's lost a lot of people, to be honest, that used to go to pride that I know just don't go, including myself. And there's no critical thinking. This is so awful, but it feels like there's no critical thought into what goes on in the pride space anymore. And it's hard to be, it's no longer a political space. Whereas, you know, the fact that it happens is itself political in a way, but it's become so watered down, as you say, particularly with the, you know, the rainbow washing and the capitalism just sort of, it's enveloped, you know, and it's so sad here. And I know why they do it, it's through sponsorship, but in Newcastle Pride, for example, you can't even take a bottle of water in with you.
That's health and safety, really, isn't it?
It is, you know, but I get really angry.
And they all fit at the women's centre, didn't they?
You're supposed to buy it inside, but then they've run out. So literally there is no water within the space. anyway, but that's just a, you know, I think it has lost people, including myself, and people, you know, that are supposed to be within the LGBT community don't feel it belongs to us anymore. And I think it's really problematic. And I think that, I mean, how to resolve that is, it's a real challenge. I think it means honest conversations with all parts of the community.
Yeah. And looking at who's organising it and looking at, is there a equality there?
Yeah.
With organisation? Yeah. And I'm sure there probably isn't.
No, I think we know there isn't. And, you know, people that I know that have been involved with it have found it quite a challenge locally. But I think in a larger sense, in terms of when you're, you know, there's a real balance to be had there. Yes, we want sponsorship. Yes, we want it to be either free or cheap for people to attend, but without losing the qualities that actually get actual LGBT people in there and wanting to go, and for it not just to be just like any other festival, but with some rainbow flags. and I think it needs some honest conversations, as I say, with the diverse communities that it's supposed to serve, and then, you know, attempting to represent those communities, as you say, in that, you know, on organising committees and so forth. But really, I think, you know, hey, I'm gonna plug it. Sort of have some training in there. Like, what does a diverse actual board look like? Because when we look at some of the LGBT organisations, they're not that diverse, unfortunately.
No, I mean, I've been to meeting before, and I walked in and was like, whoa, okay, this is not diverse in any way.
Yeah,
and they're, you know, they're trying to address that diversity, and it was great that they're trying to, but I think it comes with a bit of a pushback, actually.
Yeah.
It comes with a, well, what about us? You know, are you going to push us out? But no, we want to make equal. We want you all involved, but we just want a sense of equality, which is kind of the sense with even with the Black Lives Matter marches. We just want equality. We're not trying to say that we our lives matter over you or anything like that. It's just that it's not equal. So how can we all matter if we're not equal?
Yeah. I think that's a really important point, because, you know, the sense of actually it is going to make us uncomfortable if we change things. So, like, white people right now, quite rightly, we should be feeling uncomfortable. We should have been feeling uncomfortable for centuries. Mm-hmm. But actually, that's okay to feel uncomfortable.
It is.
Because if we don't feel uncomfortable first, we're not going to be able to listen, learn, educate ourselves, and actually, you know, create some change. Because this isn't down to, in the case of Black Lives Matter, this isn't down to black people only. This is down to us, everybody. And, it, you know, a bit of a parallel with what you've just said about the LGBT, it's like everybody needs to work together to be involved. And it's really challenging, because that does disrupt the hierarchy. So you get those sense of people, you know, these are the people that organize this stuff every year, you know, sort of nationally, you know, the national prides and so forth. And so to disrupt that is quite big, actually. But I think it needs some honest conversations. It's like, actually, is this what we want pride to have become? Is it really?
People don't really understand that there are divisions within the LGBTI community.
Yeah.
We're not all as one as people would believe. You know, there's a lack of women representation, erasure of women, erasure of people with disabilities, erasure of different races. You know, my friend's on dating, local male dating app, and he sees people on people's profiles, you know, it says no blacks, no Asians, no this, that. And it goes as deep, as dark as that. No twinks, no this, no that. And that's terrifying. But people from the outside think, oh, we're all one rainbow, we're all together, we all love each other and get on. But what society gets on like that? Because we don't have equality. So how are we even going to get on if we don't have that? And it's a shame that we don't address that within our communities, and teaching people that there are divisions.
Yeah.
And there is that. And there is a lot of misogyny within the LGBTQI community.
Yeah,
huge amount.
Absolutely.
Huge amount of disableist conversations, huge amount of race conversations, which are very negative and impact people. And yeah, it amazes me that people think that. And it's the same as how people think that all black people get along and we're all the same and we're all this and we're all that and all the races get along. No, we don't. We don't. And we need to kind of hit that from the ground up. We need to address that.
Yeah.
And it infuriates me, really. And I know it infuriates my partner as well, that the lack of addressing things like misogyny in the LGBTQI community.
Yeah, exactly. I think that it's just, it's so ironic, you know, the rainbow is supposed to be, it's supposed to celebrate different colours, you know, and different, that's supposed to represent different people, as I understand it. But we don't talk about it enough within our own community. We don't have the an LGBT community, I mean, and we don't have the spaces for it.
No, we don't.
And then you have the problem of almost feeling like you need to be able to present a united front in order just to get the sponsorship money. And,
well,
you know, people don't want to hear about differences within the community, and that some people, you know, are really hacked off with a lot of things, and enough that we've walked away. And, you know, that doesn't spin well when you're trying to get funding.
My partner, she tells me this story quite often because she tells me things a lot that she thinks she's told me she hasn't. But she was telling me about when she went, I didn't know if she went to Pride or passed Pride, and somebody was giving out those Nando's chicken vouchers. And she actually said to them, you know, the poor girl, as she says, that was trying to give her this voucher, you know, how can you reduce my sexuality to a piece of chicken? No, how can you do that? In I don't think the girl really knew what to say, but that's, you know, that's how angry she was. You know, how can you reduce people to that? How can you reduce people to a t-shirt in Primark or any other shop is available? How can you stand in allyship but sell these overpriced t-shirts and things to people without really addressing the problem? It's a minefield. But I'm hoping that at least if we address what's happening at the moment, you know, with Black Lives Matter and people understanding, you know, you hear people say, well, what's this got to do with us? It was a guy in America that died. That's just the start. This is what started the movement. But people have been fighting for this for a long time. You just didn't want to see it. And now you're forced to see it. And, you know, my partner even says, you know, the irony of that, you know, all these products, these t-shirts and things that come out, they're made in countries with bad LGBT policies.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, it gets as dark, you know, it gets deeper and darker than all that.
Yeah.
It's what people don't want to talk about. They don't want to have these conversations.
Yeah.
Because it would...
No, it's too uncomfortable for people.
It is.
It's also, you know, and it challenges a lot of people's positions and, you know, it's asking them to educate themselves. But I think at the moment, this... You know, I really hope that this isn't, you know, that this isn't forgotten, that this isn't a flash in the pan. You know, obviously we're at a real peak of kind of awareness at the moment around the Black Lives Matters. But what really matters is that this becomes actual action.
That's it.
For every single one of us has a sphere of influence, however small or if, you know, if you're an important person, however large that is. We all have some things that we can influence in terms of, you know, equalities work, in terms of putting a stopper on racism, essentially, in this context. And, you know, we can all do things. And if every one of us uses our sphere of influence, then things will change. They'll just start to change.
And I love that now we have the internet, because I feel like before all these sort of radical movements came, we didn't have the internet. And as evil and dark as the internet can be, everyone can see these things now and they won't go away. You can't hide them. They get forwarded, they get posted, they get reposted.
Yeah.
You can't get away from it.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, even in terms of being able to see, I mean, it's horrific to see, but the video of George Floyd.
I didn't know what I was seeing when I saw it. When it broke, I watched it because it was so fresh, and I just thought it was going to be sort of, I say just, but a guy getting his neck sort of sat on a bit, and then the cop would get up and leave him, and then they go to hospital and he'd die at hospital. But no, that's not what you saw.
But no, we, yeah, I mean, yeah. It's absolute brutality.
We watched a murder.
And
like it was a film.
The fact that we've seen that, we've been able to see that, is down to social media. Yeah. You know, there's not been any censorship. There's not been, it's not simply reported, as you say, in kind of in the old days in a newspaper or mm-hmm. whatever. People have seen that.
It can't be rewritten. Be rewritten. It can't be whitewashed. It is there for all to see, and it's always unedited way. I'm not going to use the word glory in all of its unedited way.
Yeah.
They cannot do anything about that.
Yeah.
Is there the same as when they saw that guy being pushed over, that 75-year-old man being pushed over and his head's bleeding? You can't get away from that. Multiple angles.
Yeah.
And it's holding people to account.
Yeah.
Which is what we can do now.
Yeah.
They can try. Sometimes these things are recorded. They kind of go slipped under the carpet. But right now, I don't think anything like that's going to be pushed under the carpet there. It's people are going to be making a point. And also what I'm hoping is that, as we're seeing, these things will be looked at again. Things that were brushed under the carpet are actually going to be readdressed now.
Yeah, that's right. Older cases hopefully being looked at again, mm-hmm. Things being unearthed and sort of treated with more seriousness than they were treated with perhaps an initial
The respect that it deserves.
Absolutely. Yeah, yes, with the respect it deserves, absolutely.
But thank you so much for joining me, Julie. It's been really good to get back to the radio and have someone as eloquent and articulate as you on the show for my first guest in 3 months.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure chatting, and hopefully it's been of interest to people listening.
Thanks again to Dr. Julie Scanlon for joining us on the Sister Sounds podcast. We'll be back again soon with another guest.